You do get to U.S. versus Gibbs.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Dan Cook, an attorney with the Federal Defender's Office for the Central District of Illinois. I represent the appellant, Michael Gibbs, in this appeal. We've raised three issues, all dealing with supervised release. The first two have to do with a 10-year term of supervised release. The second has to do with the repayment of buy money as a condition of supervised release. First two issues, the first is procedural, the second is substantive reasonableness. We've raised, essentially based on the United States Supreme Court's decision in Gall v. United States, that the district court in this case committed three significant procedural errors. The first is that it failed to properly calculate, consider the guidelines range.
So I take it your view on that is that when you have this situation where there's a mandatory minimum, that is the minimum range, but the maximum range is still the one specified by the guidelines. So here the minimum and maximum are both 5 years, and the district court should have used that as a starting point and then, you know, exercise its discretion, because obviously the statutory maximum is life.
Exactly.
And that's how it would work for the actual sentencing guidelines as opposed to supervised release guidelines.
Exactly. Correct.
What if the mandatory minimum had been above the guidelines range? Suppose it had been a mandatory minimum of 10 years and the guideline range had been 3 to 5. Would there have been a guideline range in that instance, or would we just have a statutory range?
I think there's always a guidelines range in light of 5D1.2C. I think that's similar to 5G1 point or 5G1.3C or whatever the comparable guideline provision is with respect to the term of imprisonment.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, I mean, in this case, you know, Mr. Gibbs' term of imprisonment range was 77 to 98 months. That's below. It becomes 120. So I think, you know, if the mandatory minimum is 10 years and the range is 3 to 5, it becomes 10 years.
And that's just the top and the bottom. And again, when one then proceeds, at least we have, as the Supreme Court has told us repeatedly since Booker, you can't go on without at least knowing what the proper guideline range was.
Exactly.
But the statute says at least 5 years.
Right. It sets a statutory minimum. Correct.
So the 3 years drops out. 5 years, because of the force of the statute, becomes the minimum. But 5 years, from a guideline computation point of view, also becomes the maximum.
Exactly. It's the same rationale with, you know, terms of imprisonment.
That's been pretty well established for terms of imprisonment.
Right. You know, I was wondering if the government would respond somehow, trying to distinguish terms of supervised release. They haven't done that. I see no reason why there would be it would be distinguished, especially in light of, you know, 5D1.2C and how it's set up. Seems as if it's set up comparably. The government doesn't suggest that it shouldn't be the same. So we think the guideline, you know, it's very clear that it's 5 years. Now, could Judge Conlon do 10 years? She could, but she needs to give us reasons why she's going to double up on the supervised release term. What in the record justifies that in this case? That's our second procedural argument. If she's going to do that, she needs to tell us why. She didn't tell us why. Gall makes clear that, you know, the more significant the variance, the more significant the justification. This is a 100% upward variance. There needs to be some reason for that.
He was selling heroin, right?
Oh, it's a crack case.
Crack.
It was actually just one controlled by. No relevant conduct.
Prior conviction.
He had three criminal history points, so he had one prior, I think. Criminal history category 2. The sentencing transcript in this case is 12 pages long. The first 6 pages have to do with Mr. Gibbs' due process clause argument. He raised this kind of weird argument based on a Ninth Circuit district court case that statutory minimums are unconstitutional. You know, the district court considered that pretty much half the time Like I said, it's 12 pages long. First six have to do with that. We're talking about a six-page transcript here. I mean, is that, can you really go twice the range and do it in six pages? You know, I think the bottom line is that the district court didn't understand how the guidelines work in this case. And I think that's clear from the record when she says the supervised release range is 5 years to life. Well, okay, the statutory range maybe, but Gall tells us we start with the guidelines range. And if we start with the guidelines range, then Judge Conlon got it wrong when she said the range was 5 years to life.
Well, except the guidelines are advisory, and even though the Gall case, you have to look at them, but you're not bound by following that.
Right. But at the end of the day, she still needs to adjust that. I think
she at least has to articulate that she knows what the guidelines range is before she decides that she's not going to choose to be advised by that.
I think so, yeah. I think that's exactly what Gall says. You know, the substantive reasonableness aspect, I don't know that this court will get to it because I think it's kind of unclear whether if the sentence is procedurally unsound or if you move on to substantive reasonableness. On this record, if you did that, his term of imprisonment range, the high end of the guideline range was 22 months below the statutory minimum. So, you know, he's already serving, 22 months above the guidelines range because the quantity of crack, which was a controlled buy, was more than 50 grams. And he makes his due process clause argument was kind of based on the fact that the government was controlling the quantity. And, I mean, I think that's to some extent true. So you have one controlled buy that puts him at 10 years, no relevant conduct to bump it up. He's got two. He's at a criminal history category of two. There's just nothing in this record that would make this sentence substantively reasonable. I see that I'm having rebuttal, so I'm going to keep my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cook. Mr. Murray?
May it please the Court. My name is Tyler Murray, and I represent the United States, the appellee in this case. Initially, the guideline supervised release term here was 3 to 5 years.
But that's right. That's the case under 5D1.2.
Correct. And because the defendant was convicted under Section 841, the statutory range is what governs, which is
well,
now...
Well, no. I mean, yes and no. It certainly means at the end of the day, the court, just as in all cases with statutory ranges, the judge can choose a sentence within the authorized statutory range. But that does not mean that the guideline range is, in this one instance, the statutory range. Indeed, 5D1.2b does highlight a certain set of offenses where the statutory range does become the guideline range. That is to say, any offense listed in 18 U.S.C. Section 2332b, G5, capital B, or a sex offense. But the fact that 841 is not listed there suggests that this is just a routine application of subpart C. The term of supervised release can't be less than any statutory required term, and then you look at 5G1.1 to see how this ordinarily works with sentences. I don't see any way around saying that the guideline range is 5 years. Get that ticked off, then the judge can move over to the statutory range. The statutory range certainly goes up to life. Nobody disagrees with that.
In this case, however, the five-year point serves as both the guidelines range.
It's a maximum and a min.
The restricted guidelines range, and also serves as the low end of the statutory range.
So what? I mean, the court never says that it understands that the guideline range happens to be only one thing. That happens all the time, actually. With drug sentences, it happens with things where the guideline range will be below, say, a 10-year statutory minimum, and so the guideline range becomes both a maximum and a minimum of 120, and then the court has 3553A. The court can say, well, actually, you deserve 150, and that's fine. But I don't see how under Gall we can just say, let's pretend there aren't even any guidelines in this one subset of cases.
I think the point of Gall on that front is to make sure everyone in the courtroom knows what the guidelines range is.
Precisely. And
so
here the guideline range is not higher than 5 years. And so when the judge just pulls 10 out of the air, mm-hmm. maybe, again, as counsel has conceded, maybe she would do exactly the same thing again. That's, you know,
I think to
be determined, but...
I think the point of doing that is so the court can justify any departure from that.
Correct.
And
this judge betrays no sense that she knew that the guideline cap was 5 years.
But she did justify her departure under Section 3553.
No, she doesn't know it's a departure even. She thinks the guideline range goes all the way up to life.
Right.
And
there's
doesn't.
No indication from the record that she thought that was a guidelines range. Quite the contrary, I think if you read the record in its totality, she understood that it was a statutory range.
But when you look at her language, when she's talking about the sentence itself, she discusses it in the context of the mandatory minimum and the guideline. And she specifically says, I know the guidelines are lower, but I'm going with the mandatory minimum. So you would think that the same thing would happen on the supervised release term, but that's not the case. She just says the supervised release term is 5 years to life, and I'm imposing 10 years. There's no discussion of, I realize that the guideline range on supervised release is X, but I'm going with up to life.
I think she understood, and this
but
is
for
I'm just saying
it's
not
faith. I'm looking at
right because it's not in there. I mean, the words are not there. We understand that that's what you think that's what she meant, but I'm just saying that because of the way she treated the mandatory minimum actual sentence, and there's no discussion of that on the supervised release portion.
For her to say, for Judge Collin to have said, our range here is 5 years to life, and that 5 years represents both the statutory minimum and the restrictive guidelines range.
The whole explanation is, and I'm reading from line 3 of this sentencing transcript, page 11, the supervised release term is 5 years to life. I am imposing a period of 10 years supervised release. And then she goes on to talk about the fine and so forth. That's it. We don't know about guidelines. We don't know about statute. We don't know about why she's above the guideline range. We don't know anything.
For her to have injected, though, another 2 to 3 words, which is all it would have taken, to say this 5 years represents a statutory minimum and the guidelines range, really would have been a moot exercise.
It would have been more than 2 or 3 words, because she then would have said, the reason I'm going above the guideline range is, so maybe it's a paragraph. The Supreme Court has told us we need that paragraph.
And she did provide those reasons under Section 3553.
No, she didn't.
She talked about the defendant's history and background, his age, his criminal history.
Right, but it wasn't in the context of supervised release.
Not for supervised release. She doesn't say a word about it. We're at the second to the last page of this whole thing, and she recommends...
The government did point out a couple of cases.
Buy money. She recommends Oxford, Wisconsin, drug treatment. Then that's it.
The government did point out a couple of cases in its brief. It's a footnote on page 12 indicating that in going through the Section 3553 factors, there does not need to be a distinction between sentence of incarceration and a term of supervised release.
But it's fine to know she means it for both.
Right. I agree with that. I don't think there's any reason to set out twice, you know, to give the factors when you're doing the actual incarceration term, and then turn around and do the factors again, or even it's not required to even say, you know, and so when I look at supervised release, I look at the same factors that I looked at before. I don't even think you have to do that. But I think there has to be some acknowledgement as to what the guideline range would be on the supervised release, so we would get the rationale for that as well.
When you do have a restricted range, where the range is essentially one point on the grid, that also mirrors the low end of the applicable statutory range. And that's what we have here. I think it's really a matter of best practices, not error, whether or not we have those one or two sentences added in. At the end of the day, she laid out what the range was.
And so you're asking for us, a lower court, to adopt a rule where we say, well, actually, there's one set of cases where the district court doesn't need to betray any acknowledgement whatsoever of the guidelines range, despite what you've said, Supreme Court, in Gall. So we're going to carve out on our own some exception because the government finds it inconvenient to have the guidelines mentioned here.
I'm not asking for a rule. What I'm asking for
is... Yes, you are. We have to have a rule like that in order to affirm here.
I'm asking the court to take a look at the transcript in its totality and recognize that the judge did not believe that when she said the range was 5 years to life, that was a guidelines range. It comes on the heels of her indicating that she's bound by a 10-year statutory minimum as a term of incarceration. And then she goes to the guidelines range, and I think any plain reading would indicate...
You've admitted the guidelines range itself is not 5 years to life, mm-hmm. though.
That's correct.
That's mm-hmm. only the statutory range. Where do we see in this transcript, point to me one sentence, where we know that she realizes that the guidelines range is capped at 5 years?
I can't do that.
Mm-hmm. Counsel, do you believe this could be handled by a limited remand?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I do, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I don't think I'll belabor that issue anymore.
That would be wise.
Yeah.
you think it could be handled by a limited remand?
I think it could. I guess if I have time on the buy money issue, you know, we recognize this court's decision in Dedato. We've, you know, raised it basically because there is a circuit split. We've identified it. Not only is there a circuit split, but there's a concurrence in the Sixth Circuit that criticizes Dedato pretty harshly, and we think it's just. We think if you look at 3583 D, there's you know, subdivisions in there 1, 2, and 3 before you get to this catch-all provision. The concurrence in the Sixth Circuit basically says this catch-all provision is limited by these subdivisions. That seems clear because of the use of the word and. If you read subdivision D, that's using and, not or. And the Sixth Circuit, and I think there's one other circuit, the Cotman case, Third Circuit, they agree. This isn't something that is like, because basically what happens is you go back to the probation statute 3563 and subdivision B and the relevant provisions there. Essentially, you look, are any of those similar to paying back buy money? Well, you know, both the Third and the Sixth Circuit have said no. You know, in Dedato, this court says yes based on one of the provisions that says work in community service. I don't know how paying money back is working in community service. That seems a complete stretch to me, and that's essentially what the Sixth Circuit concurrence says, is that you know, it's one thing to do community service, it's a completely another thing to pay back money. So
isn't this premature anyway?
Yeah, and I have a question about that. Can't Gibbs petition the court at the start of his supervised release and say he's unable to repay the buy money?
I think there's cases in other contexts from this circuit that come to that conclusion.
Say yes.
So,
we could say
so he could do it
prematurely.
Yeah. He could. I
and
think that would
I mean,
be a good argument. The government.
I think you're jumping the gun here, but
yeah. And I think if I were the government, I would have probably responded that way. I don't think they did, but because I think there are cases in other contexts that decided that way. So we would just ask for a limited remand. Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.